Tonight, the topic is Satipatthana and Shikantaza, a common heritage. Maybe I should... No, I won't put in a question mark. It is a common heritage. It's very bold to talk about Dogen Zenji, as I'm sure you all know. But I'm going to risk it. We'll have you go. It's very experimental, this talk. It is about heritage, so it's about tradition. Where we find ourselves, how is it that in early 21st century a group of Caucasians are sitting in pseudo-Japanese style in a meditation hall in Sydney, practicing Buddhist meditation? This is a weird thing. It's culturally a very new thing. We can take it for granted now, but it's still very new and very odd and very experimental. I've practiced in the Zen tradition and in the Theravada tradition, and kind of cross over between the two. So I want to start by talking about these two traditions, how they relate to each other. First, Theravada. Theravada, and the word means the Vada, the teaching of the Theras, the elders. These days it refers to the style of Buddhism you find in Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka. But this is actually a modern idea. It was the British who invented that idea. As you know, the British occupied vast territories. And along with other European scholars, they were trying to work out what this religion was that they saw throughout Asia. It took a while to figure out that what people were doing in China, what people were doing in Sri Lanka, actually had something in common. And then they tried to classify the different styles of Buddhism. And they were the ones who gave the name Theravada to the peoples of mainland Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka. The people there just thought they were Buddhists. They didn't know they were Theravada Buddhists until the European scholars told them they were. Since then, they've taken it on, which is quite interesting. But every Buddhist practitioner is Theravada, because everybody follows the Vada, the teachings of the Theras, the elders. And the elders are the 500 arahants who gathered after the Buddha's death for the first council. And every single Buddhist tradition is descended from those 500 arahants. So we're all terrible Vardans. I just thought I'll throw that in. But anyway, insofar as Theravada is the... Oh, and if you have any questions or comments, please interrupt. The more discussion that we have, the better. Theravada, in the narrow sense, practices for the purpose of attaining the Buddha's awakening, the same awakening that the Buddha had. The practice is guided by the Buddha's instructions. In the Theravada, if people say the teacher, they mean the Buddha. It's a very Protestant sense of a direct connection between the individual and the teacher via the scriptures. And the scriptures are Buddha Vachana, the words, the speech of the Buddha. If you read the early texts, you are reading the Buddha's words. Buddha is speaking to you. They have this sense of a direct connection. Now, these instructions are found in the Nikayas. Nikaya is a Pali word that means collection. So the collections of the early teachings, and there are five collections. The Digha Nikaya, the collection of the long discourses, Majjhima, middle length, Sanyutta, connected, Anguttara, one by one, and Kudika, miscellaneous. So these are the Nikayas, and contemporary scholars feel that the first four of them, the Digha, Majjhima, Sanyutta, and Anguttara, constitute the earliest body of Buddhist teachings that we have. That plus some texts in Kudika Nikaya. Um, if we study the Nikayas, how do we do it? If you're a Theravada Buddhist, you approach the Nikayas through the commentators, and in particular, Buddhaghosa, who lived in the 5th century AD in Sri Lanka. You want to get to the teachings of the Buddha. You want to create a connection with the Buddha. You want to practice according to his instructions, and you want to experience what he experienced. How do you find out? How do you make that connection, given that this is so remote, these texts are so obscure? You go via the commentators. You study the commentators, and they explain what the Buddha is talking about. And then through them, you read the Buddha. So when the Buddha says something, which is quite mysterious, what he means is what the commentators say he meant. So it's quite straightforward. So it's like you read back through time via the commentators in order to get to what is he teaching and what are his instructions? What should I do? If you're in the Zen tradition, what are you practicing for? Practicing to attain the Buddha's awakening. So exactly the same. Where do you find the guidance for the practice? Actually not from the Buddha, but from the ancestors. The patriarchs. Matriarchs. Mostly patriarchs, but the ancestors. So, it's the words of the ancestors that provide the understanding of what is the awakening, what is it that we're trying to get to, and how to get there, what are the instructions for the practice. And of course, these teachings are found in particular in the koan collections. So if you're practicing Zen, you have a particular interest in this body of literature in Chinese and related languages, based on the classical koan collections, because these tell you what the ancestors say. In contrast to Theravada, the historical Buddha has pretty much vanished, disappeared. When the Buddha does appear in the writings of the ancestors, he appears as an archetype, as a mythical figure, almost like a god, sometimes as a god, effectively. But not as a human being. His humanity does not come out. The humanity of the ancestors come out. So when people study the koan collections, it's like they get to know Lin Shi, they get to know Huang Po and these other characters. You get a feel for their personality. You get a sense of, oh yes, that's the way he taught. That was what he used to do. But you don't get a sense of the humanity of the Buddha. That's vanished. In the Theravada, you still get that sense, because in the Nikayas, these early collections, still present the Buddha as a human. He's presented as more than human. He's presented as more than a god. One of his titles is teacher of gods and humans. So humans are here. Gods are here. And the Buddha is way up there. So he's certainly not a god. He outranks the gods. But still, his humanity comes through. So you get nice stories. So for example, the Buddha is staying at a monastery and the monks are fighting with each other. And he's completely disgusted with them. And he says, look, you know, get your act together. You're monks, you're practitioners. You should be kind to each other and form a harmonious community. And they listen to him long enough to take breath, and they start fighting each other again. And so he just gets up and walks off and disappears without a word and goes into the forest to meditate by himself, because he just doesn't want to deal with these people. You get a sense that this is a human being. So the historical Buddha has largely disappeared in the Zen tradition, but still you see the same movement as before. How do you read the Buddha? Through the ancestors, through the commentators. And again, it's a reading backwards through time. From now, going backwards into time, to find out what's going on. In contemporary Theravada, there's a new movement. When I say new movement, it's been going on for more than 50 years, but it's a 20th century movement. A movement of modernity. characterizes modernity, and that is an attempt to sidestep the commentators and go direct to the Buddha. Now again, this is European influence coming through. When European scholars started to study early Buddhism, they brought with them, they created the field of Buddhist studies. And this was based on biblical studies. Biblical studies, as we know, it started in the 19th century. And it was very much an attempt to cut through centuries of tradition and try to get back to find Jesus. Like, is he there? And if he is there, who is he? And what did he actually say, as compared to what all these churches are claiming that he said? And hence the field of biblical studies emerges. When people started to study the early Buddhist texts, they just took on all that ideology and all that methodology. And it's essentially the same project. Let's find the human being who people call the Buddha, and let's go directly to him and ask, what is he talking about? And shove those commentators out of the way, because they're getting in the way. They've got their particular orthodoxies, but let's put those aside and try to figure out what's going on with the Buddha himself. This is, it's hard to really give this movement a name, but it's increasingly influential, increasingly popular. The commentators now are assessed according to how faithful they appear to be to the teachings of the Buddha. So instead of reading from the present to the past, it's an attempt to read from the past to the present. You see the difference? The different direction.
It's a bit like the Reformation.
Yeah, it's very Protestant. Mm. And so this approach reads the tradition through the Buddha, rather than reading the Buddha through the tradition. Could there be a similar movement in Zen? Would that be a possibility? Or is it just too much? Would it completely upset the apple cart? Tonight what I'm doing is kind of a little experiment in that direction. Now, if we're studying the Buddha's teaching theoretically, then what are we doing? We're using texts, and we're reading one text against another text. So this text says this, and that text says that, and we compare them and decide which one is right, which one is wrong, which one is authentic, which one is not, etc., etc. When we're studying the practice, we study texts because we need some kind of instruction. We need some kind of framework, theoretical framework. But we read text against experience, not against text. So it's a very different dialogue that we're engaged in. So there is a theory of some sort. What happens when I apply this theory to my practice? As I do the practice over a period of time, do the experiences that I go through measure up to what the tradition is talking about or not? And if it doesn't, who's at fault? Is it my problem because I'm a crap practitioner? Or is it the tradition's problem because they've obviously got it wrong? Or is there something else going on? So this creates a dialogue between theory and practice, where they're read against each other. And that includes the question of what method or technique should I apply when I'm doing the practice? How does one do the practice? How do we understand the practice texts that we find in our tradition? Because there'll always be some text that talks about how to practice. So how do I read that? How do I understand that? Tonight what we're going to do is look at the Buddha's teachings, some of the Buddha's teachings on sati and satipatthana, mindfulness and the way of mindfulness, or the practice of mindfulness. And we're also going to look at the teaching some of the teachings of the ancestors on the practice, and in particular, we're going to have a look at Dogen Zenjin, how he writes about Zazen, and we're going to play around with these two. Any questions so far? Here is mine.
Have the various Theravadan traditions that are carried, let us say, by immigrant groups that move to the West and they migrate, is there a shift in the way they're reading back through time once they're in a, you know, a differently influenced broad social milieu?
Usually not the immigrants themselves. They're usually anxious just to reproduce what they're familiar with in the homeland. Although that also may be quite modern. So in the Burmese case, for example, there was a major revival of interest in meditation starting in the 19th century and culminating in the mid-20th century. These are the classic Burmese meditation methods, all of which are modern. And
modern, like we would know modern.
Yeah. So, for example, the idea of a meditation technique that you apply to large numbers of lay people is a product of modernity. And it's basically the traditional monks coming out of traditional milieu facing the conditions of modernity, which in Burmese case was British imperialism, knowing that they had to respond somehow, had to somehow adapt to modernity or die. And one of the things that they decided was we must spread meditation, serious meditation, among the lay people. Therefore, how do we do that? And how do we teach them? And the modern meditation techniques are responses to that problem. And the way that meditation is taught is completely different from the way it would have been taught traditionally. So just as an example, when I was in Thailand staying at Wat Phan Annachat, which is the major headquarters for the Ajahn Sumedho lineage of Theravada monastics, which is the most popular global movement of Theravada monasticism in terms of Westernism. And I was talking about the Mahasi practice and the kind of retreats that we did, and the monk that I was talking to said, I feel so sorry for you lay people having to practice like that. Like all that intensity. I mean, we don't do that. As you can see from the way of life, we're much more relaxed about it. Because if you're a lay person and you go to do a retreat, it's difficult to take time off. You know, you've got work commitments, family commitments. So maybe you've got a week. You've got 1 week. Maybe 1 week once a year. So for that 1 week, you just have to go for it. So it's incredibly intense. If you're a monk in a practice monastery, you've got 30 years. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon. It's a whole different relationship. And that would have been the way that meditation had been practiced for centuries. So it's a very different approach. And also, you've got a room full of people. You've got maybe 50 people in the room. You're going to teach them meditation. You have to say something to 50 people. You've got to tell all those 50 people the same thing. Hence, the meditation technique. Traditionally, it would be one-on-one. And the person you're talking to, you know, because you live with this person. So the technique would not be so important. So it's a whole... look at the times that the word technique is used in association with meditation in contemporary Dharma discourse. Mm. But that's a product of modernity, that this obsession with technique. What I'd like to do, we're going to talk about mindfulness and the practice of mindfulness, so I want to begin by getting a sense of what mindfulness is. And this is also very advantageous because mindfulness, as you know, is extremely fashionable. So if you've got the edge here, it could be very useful. So we're going to do a meditation experiment. There is one thing that it requires of you, and that is ruthless and uncompromising honesty and the willingness to be publicly humiliated.
No worries.
Very good. So, I want to do two mindfulness exercises. The first one, hold your hands together like this. Question, can you feel your hands? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Very good. Question. Are you making any particular effort to feel your hands?
Yes.
You are. So it's hard to feel your hands? No? Is it fairly easy and straightforward?
Mm-hmm.
Would it fall into the category of the bleeding obvious? Very good. No?
I only felt my hands after you said, can you feel your hands? Because yeah. My attention wasn't there.
Very good. Exercise number two. What we're going to do now is we're going to sit here and feel our hands. And it'll only be for a few minutes, but what I want you to do is literally sit here, just hold your hands and feel your hands. When you suddenly realize that somehow there's a gap, that you lost track of your hands, raise one hand.
This is a marathon, really.
This is a marathon. So we begin. It's a contest. We begin now. Okay. How many people raised their hands? Very good. Those of you who didn't, how did you manage it? What was your secret?
I think it depends on how you define it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't be like a true academic.
Because if I was to be completely truthful, I lost my hand the moment you struck the bell because my attention went to the bell.
Mm-hmm.
But so then I thought, well,
you won't count that.
If I can hold it for most of the, if I can hold my attention for most of the breath,
you know, that counts as sort of being aware of the hands. But in fact, as cars roared past, as the car went past, it was sort of like, hands gone completely.
Yeah.
But just for a split second. So I guess it depends on what you mean.
Oh, what I mean is, did you lose contact with your hands?
Oh, yeah, well, I lost it in the first second.
Yeah, that's more like it.
There's also the sense of being able to multitask.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that I didn't lose contact with my hands the whole time, but I was aware that sometimes there were other things there as well as my hands.
So it wasn't exclusive. No.
It wasn't exclusive.
But the hands were there.
Mm.
How many people have just a little bit of doubt as to maybe they lost it without, yeah, just maybe. Like, very briefly. Like,
And it was like, even was, we used it for a minute, but it was actually even for a fraction of a second, that it slipped away, and then it was drawn back. But I realized afterwards, and I thought to myself, a stupid thought, which then I really knew, that I, am I thinking and feeling my hands, or am I
So when you started to think that, that's when you really lost it.
Yeah, totally.
There were times when I could not feel his hand.
Mm.
It was not there.
Mm. But
the pressure, I could feel pressure.
Yeah.
But hand. Mm. But large parts of my hand which were exercising pressure were not there.
Yeah. Yeah. This happens. When you pay attention to the body, the body, normal body's perception starts to be interrupted. When I say put the hands together, can you feel your hands? This is basically a question about awareness. Am I aware of my hands? When I say, can you maintain that awareness, and we did it for 3 minutes, that's where mindfulness comes in. Mindfulness is the translation, it was developed by T.W. Rhys-Davids. He first used it in 1881. And by the early 20th century, it had become the standard translation for the Pali word sati. And sati literally means memory. And it's derived from the Pali verb sarati, to remember. In the Sanskrit, is smriti. Mindfulness is memory. It's not awareness. It's remembering awareness. It's unlike memory in the conventional sense. Mindfulness remembers the present rather than remembers the past. This brings up the whole question of time, which is very important. Usually when people in our culture talk about time, or in particular when people talk about the present, they almost invariably add the word moment after it. So the present moment. And sometimes they just drop the word present and just talk about the moment. You should be in the moment. But, I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? Someone says that. You know what they're talking about. Is the present a moment? Well, for a start, what is a moment? A moment is a very brief period of time. Do we necessarily experience the present as this really brief sliver of time between past and future? Sometimes I do. But usually it's when I'm stressed. And I'm racing to get through something, to get to something else. But especially when I meditate, I don't experience the present like that at all. Actually, the present starts to expand. The present is actually quite large. In fact, you might try as a meditation experiment, see if you can find the border, the point, where the past becomes the present. Or when the present becomes the future. I've looked and I can't find it. All I've ever got is the present. Which means the present must be very big. So don't get caught up by this notion of moments. It's a conceptual irrelevance. Mindfulness is about remembering the present. And the present, once we start to pay attention, is actually very big.
So does that mean, I'm just thinking about Neryl and how she thought about, oh, hang on, now I'm thinking about this. Does that mean that she's having a moment of mindfulness there, or is she not?
Yeah. Or am I remembering that I'm not?
Well, yeah.
Then I'm actually not in the moment.
That brings up the whole question of distraction. You're all meditators, aren't you? Yeah. Has anybody ever experienced distraction?
Only those people who put their hands up.
Well, professional distraction.
What do you mean by remembering the present? What is the present thing?
Ah, this is what we're going to, hopefully it will become clear. If you think about, if you've been distracted when you meditate, so let's say you're following your meditation object, and then suddenly the awareness goes somewhere else. In that movement, when the awareness shifted from the meditation object to something else, what happened? During this 3 minutes, what happened? How does that work?
Something else captures your attention.
Uh-huh. And what happens to that original meditation object when something else grabs your attention?
It goes into the background.
Sometimes it goes. Sometimes it fades in the background. It's still there.
It's still there. Yeah.
And sometimes it's gone.
It's gone. Yeah.
Isn't it that we forget the meditation object? We forget that we're meditating, and we maybe get caught up in some fantasy, or we forget what we're meditating on, the meditation object. That movement from awareness into distraction is the movement from remembering into forgetting. Have you noticed how when you're distracted at first, you don't know that you're distracted? And then suddenly you know, oh, I'm distracted. I'm thinking, I'm not supposed to be thinking. That moment when you suddenly realize you're distracted, what happened?
You call them moments of pure gold.
Isn't it that you remember?
Yeah.
You forget what was distracting you and go back to what
you remember.
Yeah.
Just
drop it.
You aren't remembering the present, you're remembering the object.
But the present object. The movement into distraction is the movement from remembering into forgetting. The movement out of distraction is the movement from forgetting to remembering. And there's two flavors. There's two flavors of this memory. First of all, mindfulness is not awareness. We are already aware. It's the nature of the mind to be aware of an object. That's what it does. So we are already seeing, we are already hearing, we are already thinking. But do we know that we are seeing, hearing, thinking? The arising of mindfulness is remembering, and it comes in two flavors, remembering I am already aware. So it's remembering, oh, I'm seeing, oh, I'm thinking, I'm hearing, I'm touching, I'm walking. Or it's remembering to be aware of this, the meditation object. So if I do a formal meditation practice, I give myself something to be aware of. This becomes my meditation object. So, for example, when you're meditating, sometimes you fall into distraction, and you don't know that you're distracted. And then suddenly, oh, I'm distracted. I'm thinking. That's remembering I am already aware. Oh, I'm thinking. That's what I'm doing. That's what's happening. Have you noticed how sometimes that you realize that you're distracted and the mind immediately goes back to the meditation object? Like that. It's not deliberate. It just goes there. That's remembering to be aware of this, my meditation object. And they are the two flavors in which mindfulness operates.
What about then, as Kerry said, and as Alan pointed out earlier, you know, you're holding your hands, you're aware of your hands, you're also aware of the car that went past, or the bird.
Yeah, that's the multitasking. That's because you can hold a field, not just the narrow point. So I can hold my meditation object in the context of a wide field. Or I can hold the meditation object very narrowly so that the field is completely forgotten. It's vanished.
Because I didn't put up my hand because I don't feel that I lost it, but I was never not aware of the cards.
Yeah.
I'd have been pretty happy with that if I had sat 25 minutes like that.
Yeah, it would be pretty good.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of different flavours. So, for example, one way would be you sit there and you don't try to force the awareness to be in any one spot. Awareness wants to move. You let it move. You just follow where it goes. That would be one way of doing it.
Could you substitute choosing and not choosing for remembering and forgetting? Do you see that as different or
it's
more or less the same thing? It kind of seems to fit to me in the same way.
It fits so long as you don't have the sense of someone who's doing the choosing. It's like the mind just suddenly goes somewhere. So did I choose for it to go there or not?
When I'm distracted, no, it's like something else chooses it. But when, you started the exercise,
then you have the choice.
I committed to my choice was to try and focus on this.
Yeah. So choice is important there. Also desire is important there. We're going to talk about desire.
I was thinking about, I sort of wanted to answer Jumper's question, which he's probably forgotten what it was.
It's very difficult to answer Jumper's question, that's why I'm avoiding doing it.
But I was just thinking about intention. Like, if you go straight back to your meditation object, or if, and I'm putting words in your mouth now, but if, or if you go, oh, hang on, that's not what I'm, because I was taken away by the plane that was going everywhere. Oh, no, that's not, I'm supposed to, so there's an intention in there that pulls me back.
Yeah, and that intention is very important. When you meditate, you work on that intention. And there's a whole series of technical terms that the Buddha uses to talk about that process. So he'll talk about chetana, which is the word usually translated as intention. That's essentially the choice or decision to act. You've got adhitana, resolution, determination, and various other words which all revolve around this idea of choice and intentionality. That's very important. I mean, it's the essence of karma, basically. It's the way that we direct awareness. We choose to, that's where it's going. And part of the skill, developing a skill in meditation practice is to learn to work with that, to be able to direct the awareness where I want it to go.
Patrick, I still have a little bit of a problem with the use of the term distraction to describe the experience of hands, bong, hands, hands, because it doesn't, for me, a distraction is a loss of the sense of I am observing, there's no observation going on. It's all completely there. It's sort of like the hands are there, but something really strongly intervenes, but you're still completely present to it.
Yeah.
And then as it passes, naturally the hands come back again.
Yeah.
And that doesn't feel to me like distraction. Distraction feels more like, hands, bomb. Oh, that's a really interesting bell now. I wonder where I could buy a bell like that. That seems to me like distraction.
Yeah. it's the different flavours of the way awareness moves. It's like we can be aware but not know that we are aware. Or we can be aware and know that we're aware. So the example that I always give in retreats is it's like a classic example of driving down a familiar street and suddenly realizing I have no memory of the previous two blocks. Now, has that ever happened? Now, if I then ask myself the question, during those two blocks, was I aware? The answer would have to be yes, because otherwise I'd be dead. Was I mindful? No. Why? Because I was aware. But I was not aware that I was aware. That was the absence of mindfulness. Now, in your case, what you're talking about is where awareness is moving from one object to another, but I'm remembering that movement. I'm staying with that movement. So that's not distraction.
No.
Now, that may, if you're working in a technique that says, no, your meditation object is the breath, then you'll be stolen. But that's just because of that meditation technique.
Mm.
So, Anyway, this is... Well, I'm afraid we have to move on. But this is the general idea of mindfulness, of remembering. And the two flavours, remembering, I am already aware. Oh, I'm hearing, I'm seeing, I'm thinking, I'm moving, etc. Or remembering to be aware of this. So the first one is wide open, and the second one is quite narrowly focused. And they're the two styles of mindfulness that people work with in the course of a meditation practice. Now, the term that the Buddha uses for the cultivation of mindfulness is satipatthana, which we don't have time to go in just briefly. It's the applying of mindfulness, the establishing of mindfulness, and it's also what we are mindful of, the foundations of mindfulness, the domains of mindfulness. Now, satipatthana is a major term that the Buddha talks about a lot. It implies cultivating a continuity of mindfulness. But it's important, we've talked about technique, the importance of, in our culture, the importance of technique. And often satipatthana is presented as a meditation technique. Sometimes it might be called mindfulness meditation. It might even be called insight meditation. Often when people use the term insight with a capital I, meditation with a capital M, they're referring back to what the Buddha calls satipatthana. But when you look at the way the Buddha talks about satipatthana, he doesn't present it as a technique. This is an approach to meditation practice which is not technique dependent. There is no particular technique. Anything can be, any technique can work within this framework of satipatthana. Satipatthana refers actually to a way of life, but one which is characterized by being awake rather than being asleep, by being present rather than absent. So am I present to my experience or not? The practice of being present to experience is the practice of satipatthana. It's the equivalent, I think, of what Socrates calls the examined life. He says, an unexamined life is not worth living. Well, you could put those words into the Buddha's mouth, except a life without satipatthana is not worth living. It would fit right there. And this is emphasized when the Buddha uses words like when he describes the practitioner. This is in Satipatthana Sutta and other discourses. The practitioner is described as living, practicing satipatthana. The verb is viharati, to dwell, to make one's home in. If I'm doing a meditation technique, do I live in that? No, I'm an occasional visitor. You know, I have my formal meditation practice once a day. But what about the rest of my life? Well, satipatthana is meant to cover everything, both the meditation technique and beyond it. So first of all, it's not a technique. And secondly, it has no particular object. It's not confined to any specific object, but extends to everything without exception. The Buddha talked about one practice which he highly recommended. He called it anapana sati. Sati is mindfulness. Anapana is in and out breathing. So mindfulness of breathing. If my practice is mindfulness of breathing, and if I have a period of time where I completely forget my breathing because I'm caught up in something else, during that period of time, am I practicing mindfulness of breathing? No. It depends on that object. But if you have a meditation technique which is not object dependent, I can be doing anything but still practicing. It's universally applicable. And satipatthana is designed in that way. It's designed to be universally applicable. And so the Buddha talks about the four foundations or domains of mindfulness: body, feeling, heart, mind, phenomena. We won't go into it, but basically that's technical language for everything is part of this practice. Making sense? Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing that he says about satipatthana, which is a really radical statement, in the Satipatthana Sutta, he says, this way, the four applications of mindfulness is a one-way street for purifying beings, overcoming sorrow and lamentation, exhausting pain and grief, attaining the right path, and realizing nibbana. Now, nibbana in Sanskrit and English, nirvana, is the ultimate goal. This is the Buddha's awakening. This way is a one-way street, ekayana magga. Now, the image is this. Let's say you want to get to a certain destination. Let's say you're on a street that leads to that destination. Let's say that street is a one-way street. And let's say, as commentators add, let's say there are no intersections. If you start heading down that street, will you get to that destination? Yeah, there's a degree of inevitability there. Now, quite possibly there are many interesting places on this street. There are pubs and nice restaurants. There are libraries. And I can linger there for long periods of time. But if I keep going, I will get there. Now, it's possible that my vehicle breaks down and I have to walk. It's possible that it's uphill and it's not very well paved. There's all sorts of things can get in the way. But if I keep going down that one-way street, I will get to that destination. And the Buddha is saying, practice Satipatthana, you will get to full awakening. It may take a while. It may take a few lifetimes. It may take a few thousand lifetimes. But you will get there. It's a very powerful statement. So he's not talking about something as narrow and limited as a technique. It's talking about something much more fundamental. The central activity of Satipatthana, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha describes a practitioner surrendering longing and sorrow for the world, lives tracking body as body, ardent, clearly understanding, and mindful. She lives tracking feeling as feeling. She lives tracking heart-mind as heart-mind. She lives tracking phenomena as phenomena, ardent, clearly understanding, and mindful. So, to live, again, way of life, habitual habit, habitual state of life, lives tracking body as body, heart-mind as heart-mind, this as this. What he's getting at here is a direct, immediate relationship with the experience. So, boom, this, just this. And deliberately cultivating that relationship, regardless of what is going on, be it body, be it mind. It's just what it is. Just this. Not letting perception, the projections and stuff get in the way. Just boom. And so it's cultivating a clean, direct relationship to experience, regardless of what the experience is. Lives tracking body as body, mind as mind. Now this word tracking is very important. In Pali it's anupassana. Passana means seeing. So seeing implies a direct, immediate engagement. Right now, I see. The prefix anu denotes a long or repeatedly. So to see, direct engagement, a long, to follow something over time, to track something over a period of time. And this is the central activity of Satipatthana, to be deliberately aware of the unfolding of experience over time, regardless of what the experience is. And this is the essence of the practice. Is that making sense?
Yeah.
And the Buddha says, describes practitioner as ardent. In other words, you've got to be passionate about it. Otherwise it's not going to work. Clearly understanding and mindful. This clear understanding, sampajanya, this is the intelligence associated with continuous mindfulness. If I study something over time, I get to know it. I get to understand it. You know, one example I like to give is, if you live with someone, you get to know them. You know, sometimes my wife says something about me and I'm shocked because she knows me better than I know. Because she studies me. Because we live together. If you study something over a period of time, you get to know it. There's a certain intelligence that manifests. And this is sampajanya, this is a clear understanding. So if mindfulness is presence, Clear understanding is the intelligence associated with that presence. So that you could say the practice of sati sampajanya, and the Buddha often links these two in a compound, is the practice of intelligent presence. So this is the essence of a one-way street. Now you notice it doesn't matter what we are present to. What matters is the quality of presence, of being awake rather than being asleep, of having the lights on rather than having them off. Now, we're slowly getting to the point here. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha describes the mature practitioner, the maturity of this practice, with this sentence. The practitioner lives independently, not clinging to anything in the world. This is the culmination of the practice, to live independently, not clinging to anything in the world. Now, this word independence is what I want to focus on. First of all, what would it mean to live, in the Buddha's terms, dependently rather than independently? Well, we've already raised this issue. Why do we practice? Why does anybody come to a place like this and start meditation practice? What would motivate that?
Suffering.
Isn't it desire?
Suffering.
There's suffering and the desire to be rid of the suffering. I don't want what's happening now. I want something better. That's why I'm here. So that's what brings everybody here. So we want something else. And desire is the basis of effort. And the Buddha is quite clear about this. You know, he's quite explicit that this is why we make effort. Now, this means that we take up the practice and we discover that when we practice, our relationship to our experience when we practice is dominated by the sense of what's in this for me? What am I getting out of this? We bring to our experience, we do it even as we sit here doing our meditation practice. We are constantly judging and assessing our experience. Is this good enough? Is it not good enough? Let's say my meditation object is the breathing. Is this inhalation sufficient to my needs? Is this exhalation good enough? Or is it not yet? Maybe it'll be better later on. If I'm doing a retreat, well, maybe tomorrow will be better. Maybe the next sitting will be better. Maybe the next breath will be better. So our relationship to the practice and to our experience is instrumental. And I'm constantly trying to manipulate it so as to suit my fantasy of the future. I have this image of myself as no longer suffering. And now I've got to manipulate this experience to get to that image. Which means that this is never good enough. Because it just doesn't stack up against the image in the future. So I always have to be aggressive towards this experience to somehow shove it out of the way and make it turn into what I want. And we discover this is our relationship to experience once we start doing the practice. And this represents a relationship to the practice dominated by what the Buddha calls tanha and avijja. Tanha is craving or drivenness, and avijja is ignorance or delusion. And this creates a certain relationship to time. When the practice is supported by a sense of something to be gained or something to be lost, because if there's something to be gained, there's clearly something to be lost, then time becomes very, very real. We find ourselves resisting or trying to push through what is happening now in order to get to the future when it will be better. Or perhaps we give up in despair now because we can't imagine how this can turn into what we want in the future. So what is going to happen later becomes even more real and more significant than what is actually happening now, which is perverse, since what is going to happen later doesn't actually exist, except as a fantasy, happening now.
Doesn't it, it does happen in that that extended moment you're talking about, in that the imagined future
is now.
Is now.
The experience of imagining the future is now.
Yeah.
And that experience is characterized by drivenness and delusion.
Could also be, as you said before, could it not, like a memory of the future. Somehow you've invented.
Yeah.
The future is so imagined that it possesses capacity to be remembered.
And we invent the past. Mm. We reinvent the past.
Mm.
I'm sure no one in this room has done this, but some people, when they do retreats, find themselves reliving their lives and going through certain crucial decisions where they completely stuff things up and creating alternative lives, which is endlessly, if you've never done it, I recommend it. It's endlessly, endlessly amusing. So past and future become vividly real, even more real than present. So time becomes very strong.
The next spoonful is always going to taste better than the last.
When the Buddha talks about living independently, he's talking about an experience, a relationship to the present, which is so intimate that there's no sense of even there being a past or a future, much less it being more real than the present. Then, in such an instance, that vivid fantasy of the future is clearly seen as simply a present experience. And at that point, it isn't real. I'll give you an example. One retreat that I was doing in Malaysia. I do self-retreats in Malaysia. In a hut, in a monastery, in the hills above Taiping. I teach a retreat there every year, and I like to stay on afterwards and meditate. And one year, I was really struggling, it was really hard. When I got started, the mind was, and the heart were really disturbed. And for about 2 or 3 weeks, it was just a struggle. It was like wrestling with an opponent who would just never give up. And I just got really, really frustrated. And finally I had one of these revelations that you have in when you do intensive meditation practice. I've always felt that my major weakness as a meditator is my samadhi is rubbish. And so it's always, gotta get more samadhi, gotta get more samadhi. Anybody not know what samadhi is? Do I have to explain this to you? You're all familiar with that? Concentration.
How did you explain it?
Essentially concentration, and along with that calm, stability. So mind very, just really fixed on one thing and not moving. It's the technical term is samadhi, which actually means unification. But the English standard English translation is concentration. And then I had this revelation in which I realized that over the previous 20 years, with all the practice that I've done, with all the study that I've done, with all the teaching that I've done, because here I am, a professional guru, and with all the life changes that I've gone through, my samadhi has not improved one iota. And as far as I can see, and I'm a reasonably, as a meditation teacher, I'm a reasonably good judge of these things. And I'm not prone to fantasy. As far as I can see, for the next 20 years, if I had 20 years, it will not improve one iota. And this just appeared to me with dazzling clarity. What was really interesting was that even as that was arising with dazzling clarity, it was equally clear that it was completely irrelevant because all of it was just a thought.
Mm.
That's all. It was just a thought. And seeing that in real time was really interesting because basically the mind was going for the jungle, which it tends to do when you practice. But even as it was going for it, I could say, oh, isn't that interesting? That is just a thought. And from that moment, the retreat just transformed. And things have never been quite the same again. But that, it was very, very simple. It was just recognizing, oh, this thought about past and future is just a thought about past and future. Whether or not it's true is completely irrelevant. That's just another thought. So intimacy cuts through everything. Just And when it does that, there is only now. There's no possibility of anything else. It's just bleeding obvious. Now this is dwelling independently, or it's approaching what the Buddha is talking about. The term is anicitta. So nicitta is dependence. The dictionary translates it as dependent on, attached to, supported by. Now what this is getting at is, for the Buddha, his basic framework is what he calls paticca samuppada, dependent arising. Anything that happens, happens as a result of conditions other than itself. And it ceases as a result of conditions other than itself. So, infinite network. In the Zen tradition, you talk about Indra's net. Another, same kind of thing. Infinite conditionality. So, for example, my sense of self. Who I think I am. I think I am real. Now, in part, it's because you think I'm real. And you treat me as such. So I turn up here, and he's like, oh, hi Patrick. How's it going? Oh, come inside. Oh, we've got the teacher seat for you. Oh, we'll sit around and listen to your Dharma talk. So you're all conspiring to treat me as if I'm real. So it's quite reasonable for me to think, well, I'm real. Because you not seem to think I am. So, that my sense of self is supported by, dependent on, others. Mm. What they think I am. Also, my thoughts about myself. My sense of who I am depends on that. This is my inner drama. It's got nothing to do with you. I have my own particular inner soap opera, which is just rolling along. It's incredibly entertaining. One day I should tell it. Explain it all to you. Except you probably be bored. You probably think that your internal soap opera is more interesting. Let me tell you one thing. It isn't. Mine's much more interesting than yours. So, the drama of my life. Also, and this drama is real. So I must be real. But also, my possessions are real. And that makes me real. So, for example, this watch is real. Isn't it? Don't you think? This is my watch. Now, you may probably think this is a pretty ordinary watch and there are thousands that have been manufactured. This watch is unique. Because it's mine. Don't?
You say real as opposed to me.
Oh, I'm real? I'm using real not in a very philosophical sense, but feels real. Significant. Solid. Something I can rely upon. Something dependable. Something when I wake up in the morning, I don't have to look for. It's already arrived. So, using the Buddha's language, permanent. So, my sense of myself is dependent upon these other conditions. The social conditions, the internal conditions, the possession conditions. These are just examples. So, my reality is not independent. It's dependent upon these conditions. So this is the normal human condition. But then the Buddha speaks about independence, anicitta. One of the ways that he talks about it, in another discourse, the simile of the snake, he talks about the citta of a Tathagata. So, Zen practitioners, you know, Tathagata refers to the Buddha, but in the early tradition it also refers to any awakened one. The Buddha is describing the citta. Citta is usually translated mind, but it covers what we would call heart as well as what we would call mind. So sometimes it's good to translate it as heart. That seems to fit. Sometimes mind, and sometimes you get compromised. Heart-mind. The Buddha says, when the devas, including Indra, Brahma, and Papajati, seek a practitioner whose heart-mind is liberated in this way, they cannot get hold of anything of which they could say, a Tathagata's awareness depends on this. Why? because the Tathagata is untraceable right here and now. Untraceable. The devas cannot trace, cannot find the chitta, the heart of the Tathagata. But more specifically, they can't find what the heart of that awakened one depends upon. What it needs. What it is supported by. What it is defined by. I am defined by who I think I am. Socially, I am defined by who you think I am. But what if you can't find anything that defines you? Then the heart is untraceable. Now you notice in this text that what is the support, what enables the heart to be traced, comes via concept. What makes us, part of what makes us real is language in the deep sense of the word. The way we name ourselves and our situation. The way we conceptualize who we are, what this world is. And as human beings, we necessarily do that. But the Buddha here is saying that an awakened chitta, an awakened heart mind, cannot be captured by any concept. In Atiraga Sutta, which is a funny name, there is obsession. The Buddha uses the following image, which is very nice. He says to his students, a roofed building or hall has windows to the north, the south, and the east. When light enters the window at sunrise, where would it land? So let me ask you the question. Light, when the sun rises and the light enters the window on the east, where does the light land?
Straight through like the western window.
There's no window on the west. There's no window on the west. So the students, who are obviously on the ball, say, on the west wall, Bande. If there was no west wall, where would it land? On earth, Bande. If there was no earth, where would it land? On water, Bhante. This is ancient Indian cosmology. The earth is, underneath the earth is the great ocean. If there was no water, where would it land? It would not land, Bhante. So this is a very interesting image. The image of light falling on something. We have the expression in English, to see the light. But actually we don't see the light. What we see is what the light lands on. We see the object which is illuminated. What if you had light with and didn't land anywhere? What could you say about such a light? How could you capture that? Does it exist? Does it not exist? Or does concept fail us at that point? And if the concepts fail, what's left? Now, the term that's translated here is unlanded, and this is Tanisaro's translation. Is apatititta. A is again negative prefix. Patititta. Landed, supported. And you find the same term in Sanskrit. And this is aparatitishta. And it's a key technical term in the Diamond Sutra. And this is where we segue into Zen. Because this, all Zen students should be familiar with. Have you ever heard of Huainan? Huainan? You see the six, he was six, wasn't he? Six founding ancestor. How, when his initial awakening, how did it happen?
Yeah,
the sutra. And the sutra, the passage said? It said, dwell nowhere and bring forth that mind. Now that in the Sanskrit version of the Diamond Sutra, and I presume that comes from a Chinese version, the passage reads, the Buddha is talking to Subhuti. Therefore, Subhuti, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva should give rise to an unsupported heart, a pratitishtan chittan, a heart not supported anywhere, a heart unsupported by sight, sound, smell, taste, tangibles, all phenomena. So here he's going through the six senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, minding. The Bodhisattva Mahasattva should give rise to an unsupported or unlanded heart. A heart not supported anywhere. A heart unsupported by sight, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, or phenomena. The unlanded awareness, the unsupported heart, it's the same term. Apatititta or apratitishta. Now here you see a direct link between the classical Mahayana and the early teaching. It's the same term, used basically in the same way. The only difference is, in this first passage, the Buddha applies it to vijnana, consciousness or awareness, and in the Dhamma Sutra it's applied to the citta, the heart-mind. Now such a heart, such an awareness exists, it's real, but it cannot be described. It cannot be captured by concept. And the person whose awareness is such, or whose heart is such, equally cannot be captured by any concept. I can only describe something in terms of its borders, of what lies beyond it. So, this is Azabudham, which means that that is not. So in the most basic level of description, this is not that. So the floor supports the path. Because how do I find the path? Well, it's what is not the floor. The conceptual framework needs this network of supports. Take that away, there's no concept that applies. And so the heart or the mind of the liberated one cannot be pinned down by concept. So for example, case 40 of the Gateless Barrier. When Kueshan was with Pai Chang's assembly, he was cook of the monastery. Pai Chang wanted to choose a founding teacher for Mount Ta Kwe. He invited all his monks to make a presentation saying, the outstanding one will be sent. Then he took a water bottle and set it on the floor and said, don't call this a water bottle, what would you call it? So, capture it with concept. But not with habitual blind concept, but really investigate. So what is it? The head monk said, it can't be called a wooden clock. So what is this? Well, it's not that. That's the move that he's making. Pai Chang then asked Kuei Shan his opinion. Kuei Shan kicked over the water bottle and walked out. Pai Chang laughed and said, the head monk loses. Kuei Shan thereupon was made the founding teacher at Mount Ta Kwe. So, Kuei Shan, in kicking over the water bottle, was explaining what it was. But he wasn't trying to capture it with the concept. Basically, what this suggests is that no description works. No description ever works. From the Zen perspective, what works is performance. You do something. That works. But you cannot adequately describe. No concept pins it down.
Except it's become a story.
Except it's become a story and a cliche in its own right.
And so it fails almost immediately.
Yes, if you're too familiar with it. Mm.
So that's one of the problems, I think, with the koans.
Yeah.
They fail because they're stories.
Yeah.
Which have got... I've got, you know, all of the things that you... They've got concept.
Yeah.
Written all over them. It
yeah.
Seems to me.
That's the shadow. Mm. There's always a shadow.
It's quite shan. Lost because he had the burden of running a monastery with all those boring monks to look after.
Well, I think that's, to me, that's what he was doing. He was saying, well, bugger this, I've got to go and cook lunch.
That's right then, but that wasn't enough. He was sent to be the head. The founding teacher
so
of the monastery.
When he kicked, for me, when he kicked over the water bottle, he wasn't just being wild and zen man.
No.
He was just being very purposive.
Getting on with
it. Okay, let's get on with it.
Yeah. Enough of this bullshit.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So this brings us to Dogen Zenji. Now he inherits from the Diamond Sutra and other sources this whole idea of the unsupported heart, or the heart that does not land, or the heart that dwells nowhere. And the style of practice that he's associated with, he called Shikantaza, usually translated as just sitting. And when he presented the essence of this practice, of what he felt was the essence of this practice, he used another story, or an excerpt, featuring Yao Shan, or Yakusan, that concerned our relationship to thinking, or more broadly, concept. Dogen wrote, "Sit solidly in samadhi and think not thinking. How do you think not thinking? Non-thinking. This is the art of Zazen. Zazen is not the practice of dhyana. It is the dharma gate of great ease and joy. It is undefiled practice awakening." Now this passage belongs to the Zazengi. Zazengi?
Zazengi.
Zazengi. And there are different versions of this written throughout his career, and this passage appears in all three of his later manuals. So it's important to him. Now let's have a look at what he might mean by this in the light of the Buddha's teaching on Satipatthana and the unlanded awareness. First of all, I think let's not get too literal with the word thinking. What we normally call thinking is just the most surface activity of the mind. Thoughts themselves in the conventional sense are not so important to meditation practice that an entire approach to meditation could be defined by their presence or by their absence. They're not that important. So let's not get hung up on this idea of thinking. Rather, by thinking, I think Dogen is probably speaking about how the mind creates meaning. And this is the process that the Buddha was very interested in. He spoke a lot about this. How do we make meaning out of this experience? Now, we as human beings, we live in a world of meaning. And I'll just introduce another technical term here that the Buddha used, nimitta, which means sign, usually translated sign. Everything that we experience comes through us through the six senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, minding. For the Buddha, the mind is just another sense organ, like the first five. Let's take seeing. What is it that the eye sees? It sees
light,
essentially. Colour. The eye does not see you sitting here in the city Zen Center. The eye sees a pattern of light. The mind puts meaning onto that. What does this particular pattern mean? It means an audience sitting here getting drowsy. And similarly, the ear hears sounds, but the mind creates meaning out of those sounds. So this is a talk. So this creating meaning is going on all of the time, and it comes by naming the experience. This is what the experience is. This is what it means. So nimitta or sign refers to a label that we add, that we put on top of the immediacy of experience in order to create meaning out of it. So let's say, for example, when you're meditating, have you ever had the experience of sitting peacefully with little or no thought and then suddenly realizing that you're sitting there peacefully with little or no thought? And what happens then? Often, it just vanishes. So I have an experience which is very intimate and very subtle, but then the mind puts a label on it, names it, and in that very act, boom, I'm separated from it. I'm back into a familiar world of concept. One of the reasons why I put that name on so desperately was because when I'm actually experiencing without filters of concept, it's actually very unfamiliar to me. And sometimes fear arises. Sometimes when the meditator notices, for example, that they're not thinking, the immediate response is panic. And then, oh, blah, 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 oh, damn it! I screwed up. But if they look back and see what happened just then, often it's panic. Because meaning had just disappeared. The familiar world had just disappeared. I had just disappeared. So we are addicted to this process of creating meaning. Now this includes language, but it goes deeper than language. So for example, let's say I'm doing walking meditation in this hall, doing the Zen walk, going around the hall. So I'm walking down here, and let's assume I'm in deep concentration. Little or no thought, just really focused on walking. I'm coming down, and I know that I'm coming to the end of the track where I have to turn. How do I know that I'm coming to the end of the track? That's a concept that I've just laid on top of the experience. It's a meaning I'm imposing on the experience. It's not there in the sight. It's not there in the movement. It's not there in the touch. It's added. It's an added extra. This determination to add meaning to the experience runs very, very deep.
Patrick, isn't it just another dharma?
Which is making meaning?
Well, there's awareness of the wall that's coming and you have to turn. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it is.
I mean, you know, mental objects are no less dharmas than the touch and the sight and all that. So the arising of that thought is just another dharma. I mean, it's...
That's a relationship, isn't it?
It's not laying something on top.
If I'm intimate with that dharma, yes. But what we're talking about here is not what necessarily happens. It's the relationship to what happens. So I can be walking down here, and I know that it's about to come to an end. And I might, for example, feel relief. Oh, good, that's one lap completed. Or I might just notice it as, oh, that's just mental phenomena. But if I notice that, oh, that's just mental phenomena, I'm intimate with the arising of that mental phenomena. It's the relationship of intimacy which is what's central.
Okay, so you can have a thought object that isn't laying something on top. You're
that's
talking
right.
about a thought object that is laying something.
Yeah.
A sort of layer of meaning.
There's the meaning, but the relationship is different, and that's what we get to into.
Yeah, I was going to say sort of the same thing, and then there's that next layer that comes up, which is the feeling, you know, I don't want to run into the wall. You know, but if you're aware of that, then again, there's nothing added to that feeling. You're just aware that I want this, I don't, aversion or attraction or indifference. So you can have all those, you can have an awareness of all those things happening, but not actually be adding anything else to that experience.
Yeah, so here we come, not simply to the fact that the mind does this. It does it because we're human beings, but our relationship to it. So it's rather like, let's say I'm coming to the Zendo, and I haven't been here before, but I know it's in Yonge Street, in Ananda. So I'm looking around and I find a sign, Yonge Street. Ah, there it is. So I'm standing beneath the sign, wondering why everybody else isn't here. Now this is a mistake. Because I've mistaken the sign, Yonge Street, for Yonge Street. So, the limiter, the sign, points towards, indicates something. And as such, it's absolutely necessary. Without that sign, I couldn't find Yonge Street. But what we do is we live in a world of signs. We think that the sign that points to X is in fact X. But it isn't. The one thing that sign that says Yonge Street cannot be, is Yonge Street. A sign points towards something, it indicates something. The one thing it cannot be is that something. Yet we live in this network of concepts, and we take the concepts to be the things, the reality.
Yeah.
Now that's a relationship. That's the normal human condition. We take our concepts to be the truth. So the obvious example is the self. The self is real as a concept. And it works as a concept. But it's just a concept. It's like the weather. You know, we would say, oh, today's hot. Yesterday was cooler. Is there weather apart from this experience of being warm today? No. Weather is such a concept. It's a useful concept, but it's only a concept. What we do is we live in a world of concepts as if they are what the concepts point to. We live in a world of signs as if the signs are the reality. This is the normal human condition. It's not that there's anything wrong with the signs. It's our relationship to them which is problematic. So, we're running out of time. No, we're not. We've got
the time. That's just a concept.
That's a concept.
Petru,
just
an idea. I'm just wondering if we could maybe take a 5-minute break or something.
That's the problem with Zendoy, he's just got no stone. Terrible Vardens can just sit here for hours and listening to boring droning on. One time Upandita came to Canberra to give a talk, and I organised it. He had a small audience at the Chakramuni Buddha Centre, and he launched into this incredibly technical commentary on a medieval text. It went for over an hour, and nobody was conscious by the end of it. And he said, I'm sorry, we've run out of time, so we have to stop here. And off he went. 2 years later, he was touring Australia. I invited him to give a talk. He came to the Shakyamuni Buddha Centre. We sat down and said, now, to resume our talk. And he just started
There she was.
There's your
break. Sorry, take a break. Yeah. That was asking the dog and our perceptions. He deals quite nicely with time in which he, the same flowers don't bloom in the spring, flowers are the spring, summer is the hook of fingers, the snow.
Yeah. And again, he's that's the way I read him, I'd say. He's expressing that intimacy. That's cutting through the concepts of the flowers, the concepts of the spirit. He's trying to cut right to it, to the actual experience.
And also the concept of these abstractions like spring, summer, autumn. Mm. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Patrick, can I ask you to say a bit about what you see the role of Kaan practices sort of hovering around it and came up as just stories, perhaps?
If they don't work. But if they work, then that they trigger that intimacy. Let's say in Theravada, if I do a retreat in the Theravada context, in the Mahasi approach, what you do is you go to the teacher and interview. Now the training is to be continuously mindful of your experience as it unfolds over time. Now how can the teacher find out whether or not you're doing it? It's very simple. Please describe your experience. Upandita used to, he used to play all tricks with people. So there's a certain, like in Zen, when you come in for interview, there's a certain ritual you go through. So you approach very slowly and you do 3 bows. And so you do that and you're about to report, the past day's meditation practice. And he says, describe those 3 bows. What happened? Mm-hmm. And if you can't give a description of your experience doing those 3 bows, get out of here. You're not being mindful.
Does he use a bell?
No, he just throws you up. What they're looking for is a description, which is necessarily of a past event. Right? Which is not what's happening right now. Even in that instance, I just bowed. What happened was ... Now, you walk into a Zen interview, and you give a description of a past event. What's going to happen? Yeah, complete waste of everybody's time. What you've got to do is act now. So it's a different approach. Show me now that. I don't care what happened in the hall. What's happening now? That's what I'm interested in. So it's a different approach. Now that, what that demands, of course, is a freshness and a spontaneity, which is very challenging. And if you're skillful enough in the literature, you could fall back on, you know what the moves are. And, you know, you could...
But it's not an intellectual event, it's a character event.
It should be a character event. But maybe if you're skillful enough, you can get away with an intellectual response. Because you know all the moves of the game. So you might say, just this! Or something. You know, you throw in some cliche. Yeah. And, okay, that's the right answer.
Well, any human system can be failed.
That's right.
You cheated with, there are problems everywhere.
Yeah. Every system has its shadow. There's no such thing as an approach to practice which does not have a shadow. Mm-hmm. Every system has its shadow. And so when you, in the teaching and learning of it, you've got to be wary of that shadow and not fall into it. So it looks like we're not having a break. Anyway, when Dogen says think non-thinking, I think what he's talking about is a relationship to meaning, to concept. Cultivating a particular relationship to the way that we conceptualize ourselves and our world. The mind that is non-thinking is living independently, not clinging to anything in the world. When the Buddha says that of the mature practitioner of Satipatthana, I think this is exactly what Dogen is talking about when he says, think non-thinking. So, that brings up two aspects. First of all, how do we do it? How do we do non-thinking? How do we practice it? Well, first of all, non-thinking and non-clinging are intimately related. Non-thinking is an expression of non-clinging. If we practice non-clinging, we will practice non-thinking. It just naturally manifests. So that, then the question becomes, how do we practice non-clinging? As practitioners, what do we do? I would suggest two pointers. First of all, number one, uncover our clinging. Make it clear. Bring it to the surface. Where do we cling? Now, sometimes this is obvious, but it can also be very subtle, and it's easily missed. Particularly the most habitual clinging is the clinging most easily missed, because we don't see our habits. One way of looking for it is by investigating our distractions. What makes it impossible for me to keep my awareness on my meditation object? If I'm asked to do something really, 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 really simple, like be aware of my breathing for the next 25 minutes, what makes that impossible? What's getting in the way? That's where my clinging is. Now the clinging may be hidden, it may be underneath the surface of consciousness, but it dominates the situation. And so this is a lot to do with self-knowledge, which develops over time. Just to give an example, what dominates me is aversion. At a conservative estimate, about 95% of my experience, I would much rather it be something else. So, one time I'm doing a walking meditation, and the heart will not settle, the mind will not settle. And it just occurred to me to ask the question, avoiding what? And the mind and the awareness went to some aspect of the heart, which I was desperately trying to avoid. And I just, we just keep dropping that question in. Avoiding what? Boom. That's what I'm avoiding. That's what I'm shying away from. And that's what's causing the disturbance. Now that was very, very subtle, but it was dominating the entire experience because it was underneath what's colouring everything. For example, I'm sitting in a practice period, and I notice the half-formed thought that it'll be good when the bell goes. Has anybody had that thought? No. Well, not Zendoids, obviously. Practitioners of the Hinayana sometimes have that thought. Now, if that thought arises, that becomes really interesting. Why? Why would it be good when the bell goes? What's wrong with what's happening now that has me looking forward to the end? That is really interesting, because this is where I'm clinging. Clearly there's something wrong, because otherwise ending this situation would not be a good thing. So what am I holding on to, or what am I rejecting? Now, both of these are clinging. Clinging is holding to something, but clinging is equally rejecting something. And often the reason why I'm holding on to this is to get away from that. So this process of uncovering clinging is a process of deeper and deeper and deeper intimacy. It's like going into the chitta, into the heart-mind, deeper and deeper and deeper in, with an attitude of interest, of curiosity, of investigation. The second aspect, so first uncover our clinging, second relax and let go. So I uncover the clinging, the hard point, and there I will find tension. Whereas the clinging is like, there's one technical term, sankhara, which has a variety of meanings in different contexts, but in a, one time somebody asked Upandita, what does sankhara mean? And he said, it's when the mind goes, that's sankhara. It's like that, ooh, holding on. We notice that, and once we notice it, oh, okay, relax. Just, there's nothing, I don't have to do anything with it. I don't have to get rid of it. I don't have to fight it. Just relax. At that point. So, we cultivate the sensitivity necessary to notice our habitual patterns of tension and clinging. We reveal our own subjectivity. And when we find those hard points, just relax. That's all. And that relaxing is letting go. It is active non-clinging. And this brings us back to the intelligence within the presence. Remember we talked about sati sampajanya, intelligent presence. In one of my favorite discourses, Sutta Sutta, the cook, the Buddha compares a good meditator with a good cook. If you want to learn meditation, study cooking. Now, the image that he uses, which is normal in ancient Indian literature, is this particular cook is the cook of a king. But let's modernize it and say a cook in a high-class restaurant. Now, what is it that makes a failed cook? A cook that's useless, that can't hold a job, that's, his business is going to go bankrupt. Versus what is it that distinguishes a good cook? That is someone that, the restaurant is popular, people keep flocking in. It's got a lot to do with it. But at some point, no matter how good the marketing, you're sitting there and you're eating the food.
Yeah.
The Buddha says a successful cook picks up the sign of his customers' preferences. Now the sign is nimitta. Picks up the nimitta of the customers' preferences. In other words, when the cook is cooking, what is it that he has to pay attention to? He's got to pay attention to the customers. That's the most important thing. There are no brownie points following the recipe. It's whether or not it's the response of the customers. That's what counts. Now, if the cook is busily in the kitchen, focusing all this, flinging out the food, and then ignoring what happens out there, disaster will occur. He's got to study the customers. And I relate to this because my father ran a small catering business. And that's what he did. He was very good at it. One time I saw him, he was running this, it was outdoor catering, barbecue. But he was running this particular barbecue where lots of drunken Aussie business people. And one of the customers comes weaving towards him, clutching a bottle of wine. He says, "Jerry, mate. He says, "Mate, you've got to try this wine. You just got to try this wine. Just taste this wine, mate. Just taste this wine and tell me what you think." And my father, catapulted into the role of wine expert, said, "Certainly." He picked up the wine, and looked at it through the light, swirled it around, sniffed it, impeccable samadhi and mindfulness. Yes. Looked at it again, raised it to his lips, tasted it, went into his inner state, turned to the customer and told him blah blah blah. And the customer was delighted and moved on. Now I was watching this whole process. It was bleeding obvious. My father wasn't paying attention to the wine. He was paying attention to the customer. And he told that person exactly what he wanted to hear. That he picked up the sign of the customer's preference. And otherwise you go bankrupt. What distinguishes the successful meditator from the dismal failure? Now, of course, in contemporary Dharma discourse, nobody fails at meditation. The Buddha was very ruthless. I think I don't have what he actually said. I think something like foolish, unskillful, useless meditator, or something. He didn't mince his words anyway. What is it that distinguishes the successful meditator from not quite so outstandingly successful meditator? The successful meditator picks up the sign of her own heart-mind. That's the crucial bit. The successful meditator learns to read their own citta, their own heart-mind. If you use the meditation method to learn to read yourself, your inner self, then the meditation practice will flourish. If you are just reproducing a technique, because this is the orders, this is what you're supposed to do, then it's not going to work. I mean, it might work to a degree. Like you can willpower a certain amount of peacefulness. You can reduce your stress levels by a certain amount. Fine. But in terms of any kind of transformation, no way. It's not going to work. It's learning to read the sign of our own heart-mind. Now this is this process of intimacy, of going deeper and deeper in what's going on. Where is the clinging? Where is the holding? Gotcha. Now just relax and let it go. It's important not to be stuck in technique. This is one reason why I feel, and I must say I've always felt, that the idea that shikantaza is just watching the breath. It's just ridiculous. It's just absurd. What, Dogen Zenji was writing all that stuff and all he meant was sitting down and following the breathing? You've got to be joking. It's obviously not that. And it's obviously not just sit with the faith that you are Buddha. That's rubbish. It's much more subtle, and it's much more profound than that. Meditation involves a living relationship to our own experience. It's the relationship which is absolutely central. It doesn't matter what the object is. And this is coming back to Satipatthana. It doesn't matter what the object of awareness is. What matters is we are mindful of it. What matters is the relationship to it. It doesn't matter that we're throwing meaning at everything. What matters is the relationship to it. And it's uncovering that which is at the center. Yeah.
If shikantaza in modern Japanese is hikatsura, meaning wholeheartedly. Saying wholeheartedly, shikanta is the strike. Za, this is Abhutam. Wholeheartedly strike the cushion.
Mm.
So the whole heart of the ear, I think, is the chitta.
Yeah.
And the mind, the whole mind. Just. Mm. There. But the character of a Khan is interesting because the she is just tala, just meaning just nothing but. But the Khan is the one used for a wind instrument, the flute and so on, and it's a bamboo tube. And so I think see it as a bucket with the bomb falling out of it. Mm. Everything's dropped away. All that supporting structure, all the clinging is dropped away, and all that's left is the wholehearted me.
Yeah.
Present. And to do that takes a long time, a lot of effort. And it's not something you do for the first 6 months of your Zazen practice.
Unless you're very talented or got extremely good karma. We were talking about the practice. Next, let's look at the world characterized by non-thinking or non-clinging. The Buddha speaks about the signless samadhi, the anibbitta samadhi, and the signless liberation, anibbitta vimutti. Now, it's interesting that he uses the same word for both the samadhi and the liberation. The signless is nirvana. It's the unconstructed. It's the goal. It's awakening. That which has no sign, or that to which a sign does not apply, is awakening. So the signless samadhi, the signless vimutti, the signless concentration, or the signless liberation represents the experience of the unconstructed, or what in Zen would be called emptiness, shunyata. Now we notice that the Buddha has the signless, both as a samadhi, as an activity, and liberation, a realization. An activity and a realization. A practice and a realization. Does this echo anything? Dogen Zenji's practice realization. It's actually exactly the same thing. Except the Dogen is brought together into one compound, whereas the Buddha links them very closely in the same suttas, but not as a compound. Looked at from the perspective of realization, which is what, when Dogen does his writing, most of the time it seems that's when he's looking at it from that perspective, rather than looking from the ground up. He's looking at it from down, the other way. The Buddha mostly looks at it from the ground up, but Dogen, I think, mostly looks at it from the other direction. Looked at from the perspective of realization, how is the world of non-thinking? How does this world function? Well, we are still seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and minding, so creating meaning. But while we are in a world of experience, we are not in a world of named experience. And that's the difference. And an unnamed experience has a particular characteristic. It cannot be pinned down as anything. Later on, we can look back and we could name it as something. We could describe it. Oh yeah, that happened. More, yeah, we describe it more or less adequately. Now we have the idea of, what's the word? Ineffable experiences. But every experience is ineffable. I mean, in my experience, a taste of a good cup of coffee is ineffable. There's no way I can describe it. But we could look back and somehow describe it, even if just to ourselves, if not to anybody else. But in the experience itself, we cannot pin it down as anything, even in it. As soon as we pin the label on, we've already missed what's going on. For example, one time I can remember having this particular experience, which I thought was extremely interesting, and the thought arose, I wonder how long this will last. And when I look back, writing my notes the next day, I realised that was the exact moment that it ended. The very asking of the question was slapping the name on it, introducing time, and it wiped it. So,
and the subject of the experience,
and the one who was having the experience, yeah.
It was mine.
Yeah, and which I could then boast about to others, and boost my reputation as the great guru. So, it's impossible. We can't leap over that gap between what is actually happening and the label we put on it. Now, the time that passes before we put that label could be a nanosecond, could be a second, a minute, a month, a year, a decade. All of that is completely irrelevant because time is just a concept. It doesn't mean anything anyway. A time is irrelevant. It doesn't matter how brief the gap, the distance is that between heaven and earth. Once we've named it, we're no longer in the signless liberation and the signless samadhi. So in that experience, we find it cannot be pinned down as something. So ordinary life goes on, but we see, we hear, we think. But we learn to recognize that while our seeing, our hearing, our thinking are real, that they're actually present, they are what is happening, it is not what we think it to be. All our perceptions and judgments are wrong. And in the very act of making the perception and the judgment, it's accompanied by the recognition, this is already wrong. It's already missed the point. It can't be pinned down to this. So everything that we think is wrong. Everything that we perceive it to be is wrong. And there's a recognition of that. These perceptions and thoughts may be useful because they get us through the day, but they're wrong. And then, so what is right? As soon as we reach out to grab a label, to pin it on, well, this is what it must be, we have just clung to certainty. Oh, this is what it is. I know now what it is. This is what it is. And so I'm clinging to my need for certainty, which is another expression of my drivenness and my delusion. I'm clinging, I'm stuck, and I'm in pain. This is dukkha. But in the recognition that our label does not match, our concept, and this is in real time, our label does not match, our concept is wrong, then it's possible to completely relax into that gap of uncertainty. And this gap stimulates our curiosity. I don't know. So what is it, after all? And this uncertainty and the curiosity associated with it is the great doubt. So, but what is it, after all? And that doubt never ends, because whatever answer I come up with, I know, well, that's wrong. It's not that. But what is it? So this is the continuous practice as continuous awakening. It's what the Buddha would call sati sampajanya, mindfulness and clear understanding, which he portrayed as a continual process that goes on throughout the day. When we think we know, we fall back into a habit, which means we fall back into our habitual clinging. We're asleep. But when we know that we don't know, then we stay alert. Because we genuinely don't know what this is, and we genuinely don't know what happens next. One experiment that I practiced in a retreat, again in Malaysia, every evening at about sunset, I'd walk from my hut down this path to where there was a hot water dispenser. I'd make a hot drink in the evening. It was a monastery, so there was no evening meal. And I would walk down this path to this hot water dispenser every single evening at about pretty much the same time. And I made my meditation exercise was I was to walk down very mindfully, just following the walking, and just checking to see if I thought I knew what would happen next. And most of the time I did, but sometimes I genuinely didn't know what would happen next. And it was really nice. It was incredibly nice. It was impossible to pin it down. Well, eventually I would pin it down, but then it was gone. But to walk with that complete uncertainty, that I really didn't know what would happen next, it was just wonderful. It's very, very ordinary and very, very wonderful.
Not knowing is most intimate.
Exactly. So this is what Dogen, of course, calls beginner's mind. Or, as that great Zen master Leonard Cohen puts it, ring the bells that still can ring, forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. And that's it. And it's right on top. So, tiny. Thank you. Any questions or comments before we finish off? Silence of full awakening.
I'd like to thank you for pulling the rug out so effectively. And for so much food for not thinking. And this is a little gift to say from us, the Zen Center, to say thank you, Patrick.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
How does that link up to if that isn't enough guidance for the meditator, then is that because he's saying it poetically?
Yeah, he talks about practice realization, and most of the time he's talking about that from the realization side. Now, we don't know when people came to him, his close students. We don't know what he told them. We don't know what his instructions were. We don't know what he was fishing for in an interview. We have no idea. All we've got are his writings. So, it's just, we don't know, actually. And it's the same with the Buddha. We don't know what he actually said to people when they turned up for an interview. That sort of thing is just unknown. So, we have to figure it out for ourselves. And this is, I mean, practice is something that's reinvented with every generation. Because people somehow have to figure it out. Like in my case, I mean, I notoriously left Zen to go to Theravada to learn how to meditate. Because in the Dharma Sangha they didn't teach me. And the Roshi had no interest in talking about meditation. He just wanted to know what Mu was. I didn't know what he started. So when I went to Mahasi Center, they taught me how to meditate. And I went through a particular kind of training. Now I'm teaching. I don't teach the way I was taught in Burma because it's completely inappropriate in this culture. So I'm reinventing the way of teaching, which means I'm reinventing the way people learn. Now on their side, they're not simply empty ciphers that I'm filling with knowledge. They're engaged in this themselves. And they're reinventing it. And so it keeps being reinvented. You can't pin it down. There are certain broad principles you can apply, but you can't actually pin down. There is no such thing as the one true technique. It's another way of looking at it.
We've had an interesting experience over the last, I think it was 2 Easter sessions, I think, where Jeff Ward, who's had a lot of experience with Shikantaza, did some guided meditations in which he was sort of drawing on silent illumination things, that, including things from the tree dog and things in China, you know. From, things like that. So over the course of several days, he had us do a practice which began with focus on your breath, and then forget your breath and focus on your body, because the body will know what to do after a day or two of that. Forget, let the body go and become aware of the mind. And then the last step was let go of the mind, which was very interesting, really interesting. So there was, you know, definitely, I mean, obviously there's a tradition lying in behind that that is articulated in different ways, either, you know, through the sort of tradition, but also by reference going back to, you know, the general thing. So, you know, that we've sort of had that experience of, an experience of shikantaza that deliberately takes us beyond, just uses the breath as the first step, and then takes the little steps after that.
Yeah. Mahasi has a similar approach that he starts people on the breath, says to everything. But then, the way he talks about it is in terms of what gets translated in English as primary object and secondary object. Now, I don't know what the original term secondary object is, but primary object, the Pali is mula aramana. Aramana is object, sense object. And mula literally means root. So it's like your grounding object. So if you start doing a meditation practice, the first thing you need to do is to ground yourself. So you need something to hang on to. You need something to ground yourself on. That's your grounding object. And then whatever gets in the way of that is your secondary object. And then at some point, as the practice matures, that whole distinction falls away. And it's just whatever it is that's happening. For some people, they will go to the mind very quickly. It's just their natural inclination. Other people, they work with the body mostly. That's just their natural inclination. And then you get all sorts of variations in the field.
You started this evening talking about Dairy Zen and the Theravada practice, and saying that one is starting from teachings of the masters now from the teaching of the Buddha. So there's a textual base for both streams. And that here we are in the West. Asking how come we're here? Well, in many ways we're more than doubly removed, because if you take the case of Dorian, for example, by the time he was 18 he had read the Tripitaka 3 times. And you read anything of Mungpo, and within the first couple of pages he's making allusions to 20 different sutras. These people are intimate with classical Buddhism. Dorian embraced in the Tendai sect, which is a teaching school, which does nothing but focusing mainly on reading. We, very few people in the West have either Japanese, Chinese, or Sanskrit. So we are in some way sort of floating in a virtual reality of Buddhism. And in some ways, all that we can, in the Zen sect at least, we can, because we don't have access to that literature and the conceptual structures, we have to go to the experience. And because it's in, ultimately, that's where we find our ground there. And I think the reason that people like Dogen and Rinzai and so on, they themselves came to Zen because being scholars of the literature, they found their heart was still not settled. The words were not enough. And that's what Dogen and Bodhidharma said, no reliance. Didn't say not use him, but no reliance on him, no being supported by him in the teaching, direct teaching outside the sutras.
The other thing is that students actually don't need to know very much in terms of the theory. But teachers need to know something. I think that's where the problem lies in contemporary Western Dharma, is the ignorance of the teachers.
Because you're an example of somebody who has access to the Pali texts
that are getting as close as most people would to the Buddha's original words. Did you say that? Yeah.
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 That's right.
So, you know, and that makes you rather exceptionable. You're beyond to a minority of practitioners. And also, there are a lot of scholars that don't practice, a lot of practitioners who are not scholars.
Yeah.
You seem to have a very fine, a very wonderful balance.
But that's what the tradition, I mean, ideally, the normal training for monastics is first you practice meditation. It's first you study, then you practice. And you bring them together. One time, Sayadaw Uri Vivekananda, he's one of the main teachers in the Parsi lineage these days, he's German, ethnic German, and I met him in Burma when he was Upandita's interpreter. And I used to go to him, it wasn't Upandita, at that time, the teacher giving the interviews wasn't Upandita, it was one of the underlings. This is Upandita's place, but Upandita was not giving the interviews at that time. He was one of his junior monks. And he was probably the worst meditation teacher. No, one of the worst meditation teachers I've ever endured. He was useless. He was completely hopeless. And Vivekananda was the interpreter. And I knew the system well enough that when something interesting happened, then after the interview, I'd go and see Vivekananda. Go to his hut and say, okay, so what was that all about? And we have this talk. And I was complaining to him once, I said, how long before the Sayadaws start to actually open up and start to explain things and tell me what's going on? I mean, what do I have to do to prove my loyalty before they start to explain anything? And he said, don't take it personally, which is always good advice. He said, they don't even talk to each other, much less to the students. What they do is they go through, each one individually goes through intensive study, from about the age of 7 until they finish their exams before their 30th birthday, because you can't take an exam after that. Then they practice, and then they put it together for themselves. They don't even talk to each other. So don't expect them to talk to you, because they're not going to. And that's the Buddha's style. But it is this bringing together of theory and practice. And everybody does that. Including people who know Bhagavad theory. They'll just take the theory from somewhere else. So in contemporary Dharma world, from psychology. They'll take it from psychology, from pop psychology, and fuse it with the practice. I think that's the weakness where the theoretical framework is weak. So the capacity to fuse it with the practice is weak.
Well, I think the great quality you bring to these talents is the fact that at no time do you take yourself seriously.
Well, I don't know enough.
No, but you carry it all pretty lightly.
That's because I'm fully enlightened.
That's where the license comes from.
Correct.
That's a good thing.
Okay.
Thank you.